Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In a world where data rockets past us at light speed, it is always a fascinating exercise to turn conventional wisdom inside out to see whether it holds up to scrutiny. That's one reason many people are drawn to the work of the Freakonomics guys, journalist Stephen J. Dubner and economist Stephen D. Levitt, two people who derive great pleasure exploring the world through a curious and often counterintuitive lens. Their newest book, drawn from several years of blog posts and columns, is called When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. Here representing the team to talk about it is Stephen J. Dubner. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much.
What does it take to train yourself to think about everything in novel ways?
I'll be honest with you. What we do seems harder than it is. And I don't think that's false modesty. And I don't think it's, you know, my partner, Steve Levitt, is a very, very, very smart in the traditional IQ sense guy. He's a PhD economist. And I'm, you know, I'm moderately average person, moderately or slightly above average, rather, intelligence person, maybe slightly. But it's much more about learning how to put aside your biases and what scholars call your priors, your prior beliefs, and really just kind of taking a fresh look at situations and scenarios. And the easiest way to do that is to gather data to find data if you don't gather it yourself. So rather, you know, when something happens and you start to worry about, oh, my gosh, you know, I read about this horrible event, you know, whether it's a terrorist attack or a certain kind of crime or certain kind of, you know, infection or disease or something, rather than, or, you know, a shooting, on and on and on and on, the things that make our news make us panic all the time, rather than just give in to that, you know, one of the first good questions to ask is, well, how normal a thing is that? Is that a normal thing or is that an anomalous thing? Let's find some data. And so a lot of what we write about in this book, but throughout everything we've ever written, is that, you know, human beings are terrible assessors of risk. We're really not very good at knowing the things that are truly dangerous to us or at least worrying about those things. And meanwhile, we get way bent out of shape about other things that are while scary and noisy, but very rare. So really, I think if people just invoke common sense a little bit more, learn to find data and look for it, and then the big piece of what we do is really try to understand incentives. What are the incentives that make people behave as they do? And our mantra would be that rather than thinking of the world as divided into, quote, good people and, quote, bad people, I think that's just way too facile and probably too moralistic. I think the truer notion is that people are people, and the same person can do a good thing in one case and a bad thing in another, depending on what the incentives are. And so if you think about whether you're a family, a firm, a government, a society trying to create the incentives that get the most people to behave in the way that we want them to, what we really need to do is understand what are the incentives they respond to, gather data to see if they really respond the way we think they're going to respond, and then try to make some headway. So to me, that's not that complicated, but unfortunately, it is a little bit rare.
One of the things that you are drawn to is the fact that economists don't go with anecdotes. They go with data, as you were talking about. And that really is a big change from a lot of what we see, even in journalism that is trying to be unbiased. We're drawn to stories rather than facts.
Yeah. You know, look, I'm a journalist by trade and I love journalism. So I'll defend it to its death, which unfortunately may not be that far from now.
But, let's hope not.
No, I don't think that's true at all. So it is true. Okay, so I'll say two things about that. One is you're absolutely right in that it's very easy to make a – you know, I used to work at the New York Times where we would joke and say, you know, I heard about this happening and then someone else heard about it happening again and then someone else heard it happening again. Three makes the trend. It's a story, right? So if you're a social scientist or any kind of scientist, you say a sample set of three, that's ridiculous. There's no way. But it is true that the history of journalism is one that often tells stories around very small sample sets, right? So that's one. Two is, you know, don't forget the root of the word news is new. And so when something new happens, it captures our attention. Usually what captures our attention that's new is something that's very anomalous, something that doesn't happen all the time. And then it gets publicized a lot. And our brains, which are wonderful machines, but they also have some pretty outdated software in them, apparently. We look at those anomalous events and treat them as though they're much more common than they are. And that's just a very easy mistake to make. I will say this, however, I think that journalism has really caught the gospel fever of using data to tell stories better. So not only are there a lot of new journalistic outlets and sites that are built on that idea, like 538.com and sections of the New York Times like The Upshot, which are really data-driven journalism, but I think everywhere we've all become a little bit more, not only news producers, you know, journalists, but news consumers, we've all gotten a little bit more sophisticated about understanding the difference between a story that might be entertaining or might be scary or might be whatever, and an actual trend, you know, an actual movement, and how to be, hopefully we all learn a little bit how to not be scared of the wrong things more often.
One of the wrong things that we're scared of is the whole stranger danger phenomenon. We still have the sense that there are people sort of roaming the streets wanting just to randomly, you know, harm us and kill us.
Yep.
It always struck me when I was a regular reporter on the street, people really worry about that, and they don't worry about things like accidental discharge of a gun at home, which statistically is more likely to harm us than some stranger.
That's a perfect example. You know, also, look, you know, these days there are more traffic accidents, fatal traffic fatalities in America than there are murders by a long, 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 long shot. Even there are more traffic fatalities than there are gun deaths. Gun deaths include suicides, which are about two-thirds of murders, or two-thirds of all gun deaths. So you could say that there are more, you know, more people are killed in traffic accidents than by gun, period. And yet, we think about and what we see on the news is much more, you know, if there's a shooting, a fatal shooting especially, we hear about. Now, there might be good reason for that, because a traffic accident is by definition, theoretically at least, an accident, meaning it could have been prevented, whereas gun deaths are often sometimes accidental but often not. The problem is that it's easy to skew. It's easy to lose sight of the dangers that you can actually do a lot about. So, you know, look, diet is one of the most interesting wrinkles here. Even though we don't know as much about nutrition as we should, and or as much as we think we know, the fact is that we have a pretty good idea of how to feed ourselves that's fairly healthy, and yet we treat the risk from that as a much, much, much lesser risk than the risk of, say, getting, you know, shot by a stranger or getting blown up by a terrorist, whereas those risks are incredibly small. And then when it comes to, yes, being hurt by or kidnapped by or beat up by or murdered by a stranger versus someone we know, if you look at the data, again, on homicides, on sexual crimes, on kidnapping, much more often the victim and the perpetrator know each other. And yet we tend to carry around this fear of the stranger. Look, you know, we're scared of being ripped off all the time. One of the biggest ripoffs in history was perpetrated by Bernie Madoff, who either personally or through one or two, you know, degrees of separation knew his victims. So with friends like Bernie Madoff, do you really need to be so scared of the Russian hacker who might get to your banking account? You know, it's not that we shouldn't be scared of anything, but we probably should be scared a lot less generally. And we should learn to try to weigh the risks a little bit better, and definitely not to be so scared of random strangers, as you said, you know, walking up to us and doing something terrible. It does happen. It's often tragic when it happens. But to turn that tragedy into your philosophy for living life, I'm not going to go into that park because I heard that someone got beat up there. You know, that's just a very limited way of looking at the world.
It might be sort of, I don't know, atavistic holdover that we seem to fear things that can happen to us immediately and cause immediate consequences more than long term. And, you know, you talk about diet. I'm thinking about, you know, environmental damage. It sort of seems like that's so far off in the future that what we're doing right this minute couldn't possibly make a difference.
That is very true, I think. And, you know, economists have a slightly different way of looking at it, a slightly different term for it. They talk about discounting and hyperbolic discounting, which basically means that—
It's a great term.
We count the present a lot more than we count the future. And this can be good in some ways, right? Live life in the present, et cetera, et cetera. But it can be pretty bad in other ways. Bad in the way that you mentioned, which is, you know, I'm going to worry a lot about, walking on the right side of the street so I don't get beat up or mugged. But I'm not going to worry about eating, you know, a gigantic pile of food that if I eat this gigantic pile of food every day is probably going to be pretty bad for me in the long run. So that's one way. But another way that it's really bad is financially. I mean, this is the reason why many people have a really hard time, let's say, saving for retirement or saving to buy a house or saving for education. It's because it is a lot more fun to spend a dollar today than to save a dollar today that will become $2 or $3 or $4 tomorrow. Even though intellectually we know that $2 or $3 or $4 will be valuable, a lot of us, you know, the human brain seems to be at this point in our evolution programmed to want it now. And so if we want to better ourselves to save money, for instance, then sometimes we need to kind of trick our brains. So there's a whole school of, you know, behavioral economics that we write about a lot and all this Freakonomics stuff. And it's basically coming up with nice ways to nudge or trick or commit yourself to doing things that you know you should do, but kind of wouldn't, that you wouldn't do if you didn't, if you were left to your own devices. So, you know, one good example is this savings program called SMART for Save More Tomorrow. Every time you get a pay raise at work, you devote a little bit higher percentage of your take home to your 401k, for instance, right? And what that does is you're still getting more money every week because you got a raise, but you're putting a larger and larger proportion of it away, which is good for you later. But we really need sometimes to trick ourselves because that does not come naturally to most people. The people it does come naturally to are mostly economists.
You propose a fascinating idea for getting better politicians or better work out of politicians, and that is cash bonuses for the ones who perform well. This seems like, you know, anathema, and yet it makes a certain kind of sense.
I'm glad to hear you say so, Chris. You're not necessarily in the majority when you say it makes sense because, you know, okay, so this is kind of a two-parter. One is, what would happen if we just paid politicians a lot more, right? So we think that if we send someone to Congress, let's say, that we are just giving them a license, you know, a blank checkbook for the rest of their lives, which it kind of is. But mostly that's because when you get there, you can build and consolidate power in a way that during, but especially after you're in office, you can make a lot of money by lobbying and all different kinds of things. So that's one model. That's the model we have now. So what if instead we said, you know what, let's say that rather than that model, which we collectively don't like very much because we think it perverts the incentives that politicians have, what if instead we just pay politicians a lot more? So what if, you know, instead of city council paying whatever, $30,000, $50,000, what if it paid $100,000? Would you get a better quality of person in that job? Just the way Google wants a better quality of person in the job and therefore hires pays a higher rate than a lot of other companies. So that's one. But the other part of this idea that I like a lot that is even more impossible than that is, yeah, as you said, what about cash bonuses? Or basically it's like stock options. So the way this would work is, let's say there's an elected official, let's call it the federal level, or maybe it's a cabinet secretary, Arne Duncan, let's say, the transportation secretary. If he does something that 10 years from now really raises test scores across the board, hey, let's write him a check for $5 million and the other 100 people involved in the program. And if we tied their work to their real incentives, I think we could change the dynamic of how politics works.
My guest is journalist Stephen J. Dubner, co-host of Freakonomics Radio and co-author of When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen J. Dubner, a host of Freakonomics Radio and co-author, along with economist Stephen D. Levitt, of When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stephen, you're anti-penny. Why are you anti-penny?
All right. I guess at this point, reluctantly anti-penny, but not that I don't hate pennies any less. I do. I hate them with all my heart. It's just that I don't want to go down as the guy who hated the penny because it's so trivial, okay? But that's partly the reason I hate it so much. Look, we have a coin in our currency that the government makes at the cost of more than a penny, by the way. So every time we make a penny, we lose money, which is bad. And then because they're so valueless, most pennies go out of circulation very quickly. So they're even more valueless to the average person. And yet we keep them, while many other countries have eliminated their smallest currencies that inflation has rendered valueless. So it's ridiculous that we make it. Why do we make it? Mostly nostalgia, inertia, and the zinc lobby. Zinc, you know, the pennies are mostly made from zinc now. The zinc lobby has very cleverly come up with and supported a project, among others, called Americans for Common Sense, C-E-N-T-S, which helps, you know, school children run penny drives. And they say, oh, it would be so terrible. What if those poor children can't collect their pennies? My answer would be have them collect dimes or dollars, even better. If you're trying to raise money, why teach the value of something that has almost no real use in the world and you have to collect, you know, 1,000 of them just to get 10 bucks? If you want to teach how to fund things, how to fix problems that cost real money, why are you not using real money? So, yeah, I'm pretty anti-penny, and I do terrible things like throw away pennies when I get them for change. Or I try to always give them back to the cashier, and if they can't take them back, I will leave them in my grocery bag. I teach my children to throw away their pennies, even their nickels. I guess that makes me a bad person, and it might even be illegal, but if it's illegal to do that, then it's got to be illegal to throw coins in a wishing well, too. So I stand with all the wishers of the world in my anti-penny feeling.
So you actually would put pennies into a landfill rather than like into a cup on your dresser?
No. Well, okay. Now you make me sound like a really bad guy. Put them into a landfill. No, I would stop making them. It is a huge waste of everyone's time and resources and a lot of money. I don't know. You know, this has been calculated, but I don't recall and I don't have it at my fingertips and I didn't calculate it. But the amount of money, if you want our federal government to save a lot of money with something that would be really easy and that wouldn't hurt anybody except for maybe 10 people in the zinc lobby, you would get rid of the penny. You'd save lots and lots and lots and lots of money. So if my only choice is put them in my drawer or throw them away, yeah, I'm, like most people, a kind of self-interested person at the end of the day, and I don't want them in my drawer. So I do, like I said, try to give them back, but if I can't give them back, then I throw them away.
You include in the book a fascinating guest blog piece by James McWilliams of Texas State University. And I have to say, I have been one of these people who rails against seeing shrink-wrapped cucumbers in the store.
This
made me rethink that a lot.
Yeah, it's very persuasive. He's a great, you know, he's an historian who writes a lot about agricultural issues that border on what we think of as agricultural economics, even though he's not an economist. And yeah, I thought this was a fantastic post. And this is really the spirit of what we try to do in this book and all at Freakonomics is just, you know, you take something like that you've seen maybe 100 times and, you know, maybe the first 5 times you saw it, you kind of thought about it a little bit. But then, you know, life is busy. You don't want to think about every single thing you see every day. You'd never get anywhere. And then you just take it for granted and you see, you know, this is a good idea. That's a bad idea. And the idea that he was looking at was whether when people sell shrink-wrapped or, you know, plastic wrapping around fruit or vegetables, isn't that a huge waste of resources? And it would seem to be like, if I want to buy, you know, 6 apples in the grocery store, wouldn't it be much better if I just take the 6 apples out of a big bin and put them in my shopping bag and go home and put them in my fridge or wherever you keep them and then eat them? And that would be good if all humans were totally optimizing and used up everything that they always bought for the purposes that they bought it for. But the truth is that we throw away an enormous amount of food in this country. There's some estimates that we throw away you know, somewhere between 25% and 50% of all the food that we buy. So that's even the stuff that we buy. Forget about the stuff that isn't bought or the stuff that's wasted in production and so on. And so what happens when you buy 6 apples and you bring them home and you end up eating 3, then the others start to turn kind of brown, you throw them away. Well, they go into a landfill. Maybe it's compost, but typically it's getting picked up by somebody who's hauling it off somewhere. Well, it turns out that plastic wrapping, the very simple act of that very, 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 very thin piece of plastic, will keep your fruit and vegetables fresh and edible for a lot longer. So like everything in life, it's a trade-off. We might think, oh, plastic is unnatural and therefore bad for the environment. But it turns out, in this case, the use of plastic is, on balance, good for the environment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Mark in Hearst. Hi, Mark.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
On KERA. Really kind of confused about looking at the nowadays, or I guess almost like hidden costs.
You know what, Mark, I'm so sorry. You're really breaking up there, but I see from the screener report you wanted to talk about illuminating hidden costs, and one example is the California drought. Can you talk a little bit about that, Stephen?
I'm so glad that was the connection. And not, I thought my hearing was going, so
no,
I'm
you're
glad
fine.
That you were here that as well. Yeah, so let me begin by saying that in terms of the particulars of the California drought, I know next to nothing. In terms of the basics of what happens in a case like this, from an economist's perspective, the answer is very simple. Water is mispriced. That's a no-brainer. I mean, if you think about it, if you want to buy a gallon of water here in New York City where I live, right? If I want to buy it to drink a gallon of water, let's say, and I go into a store, let's say there's 16-ounce bottles of Poland Spring, right? And each one will cost $1.50, or let's call it $2, which sounds crazy, but that's what it costs in New York. And so if I want to buy a gallon, I think there's 64, 128 in a gallon. How many ounces in a gallon? Right, so that's eight of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
So $16 a gallon of drinkable water to buy in New York. A gallon of gas costs these days about $3. So we always talk about how the price of gas is outrageous and too expensive and so on. So compared to what we pay for water in that circumstance, gas sounds like a bargain. Too bad we can't drink gas, right? It'd be a lot better. But then you look at the uses of water elsewhere and who pays what for it. And in California in particular, but in a lot of places, through a series of decisions made by three people in a room 100 years ago and through a bunch of accidents of history, the pricing of water is not according to what the market would price it. So if I have 5,000 acres of land that I want to grow fruit and vegetables on, and water is a resource that I'm competing for with other people who want to drink it and use it for their laundry machines and so on, then that's going to dictate the price. But when you have deals that dictate that someone can get a whole lot of something relatively valuable for really, really, really cheaply because it kind of evolved that way, that's not market forces at work. And so if you want to deal, the drought is a function primarily of nature, obviously, although we divert a lot of water. But if you want to deal with the result of that, which is water shortages and increased demand, then you need to price something. You need to let the market help you price it. You find that almost always when you try to set prices artificially, people respond to those incentives, and it results in a kind of perversion of the activity or the behavior that you're trying to regulate.
Another thing that uses a lot of water and ultimately a lot of carbon is the production of meat for human consumption. And yet we talk a lot about our cars and not so much about what's for lunch.
Yeah, that's true. And beyond those two very significant things, you've got the fact that many of the animals that we eat for meat, and I don't mean, you know, I'm a meat eater. I'm not going on an ideological or hypocritical rant here. Many of the animals that we eat for meat also, just by their existence, are great polluters, right? So cows, for instance, emit a lot of methane, which in terms as a greenhouse gas is a lot more powerful, potentially damaging than CO2. So yeah, if you want to talk about producing the fewest greenhouse gases possible, which is something that a lot of people do want to talk about, which is not the only solution treating the environment better and probably not the only solution to climate change as well. But if that's your goal, then to focus entirely on transportation is a mistake because meat production is very, very, very carbon intensive. And so one argument in When to Rob a Bank is, hey, if you belong to an environmental group that wants to cut down carbon, then if you are really living your message, then you should absolutely, you know, go vegan as well. Before you decide to trade in the Prius for a bicycle, you should go vegan and you're going to do the world a lot more good.
How is it that sometimes I can walk into a grocery store and pay less for a bag of kiwis or a bunch of bananas than for peaches grown in Texas?
Labor costs, and land costs. So, you know, I don't know much about the Texas agricultural real estate market. I live in New York City. I grew up in upstate New York, which is apple country. There, the land is relatively cheap, upstate New York, compared to, let's say, you know, somewhere in Africa where you can buy farmland, or somewhere in Australia or somewhere in New Zealand where they grow a lot of apples. But as it turns out, yeah, the apples from New Zealand are cheaper. Why? Land is going to be cheaper, labor is going to be cheaper, and shipping, which we think is really expensive, is really cheap. So you can put many, 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 many hundreds of thousands of apples or kiwi fruit or bananas on a cargo ship, on a container ship, and bring them over here and sell them in New York City in a way that makes a kiwi fruit, which is grown thousands of miles away, cheaper to buy. I can buy one kiwi fruit and one banana, neither of which are grown within, you know, 5,000 miles of me. I can buy those cheaper than one apple that's grown in upstate New York. That's economics.
You have an essay in the book about the fake memoir phenomenon, where people have produced what they said were memoirs, and as it turns out, there was a great deal of creative and factual license taken. First of all, why do the same stories sell better if they're marketed as memoirs than as novels?
You know, we asked that question. A lot of the questions we ask, or a lot of the answers we try to give, we can give the what part of the answer, right? The data can tell us what is happening, but the why is really hard. And that's the fun part of life, too, is to try to figure out why people behave as they do, why we have the preferences we do, and so on. So why, you know, but that was the question I asked, is why do we seem to prefer, why do so many fake memoirists write that what are essentially novels and pretend that they're memoirs? And I guess the answer is because we are more excited about hearing their stories if we think they really happened to that person, which I guess is kind of obvious and makes sense. But one result is that, yeah, as you said, a lot of books that get published as memoirs turn out to be fabricated. And the same book, if you were to put it out, this is the experiment that we propose. You know, if you take the identical book that has a life of somebody who, you know, was living in some kind of crazy environment, let's say they grew up in the circus and their parents were both, I don't know, left-handed magicians who beat them every night, and they had to, you know, raise all these weird exotic pythons. They were the family, you know, all this crazy, crazy, crazy stuff. And you take that same manuscript and you give it to, let's say, 500 people to read it, and just call it a memoir, 500 people to read it, call it a novel. My hunch is that the memoir people, the people who think it's a memoir, are going to grade it a lot higher. So what that says about us as human readers, I don't quite know, but it seems to be a fact that we have a perverse interest in hearing about the perversions of other people's lives, especially when we think that they're true, when they happen to the person telling us the story. And my one caveat is that I promise that everything I've told you in the last 38 minutes has been, to the best of my knowledge, 100% true, at least 98, let's call it.
I appreciate that. We'll get our fact checkers right on it. what's interesting, though, Stephen, is that in the past year or so, I've come across a number of clear memoirs that people have called novels. And Akhil Sharma's book, Family Life, comes to mind, but there have been a couple of others that have been notable. It's almost like people now are just hedging their bets. They'll say to you, yes, this is my life story, but I'm calling it a novel.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. So if I had a guess, I'd say that's right. It's because the cost of writing a memoir, of publishing a memoir that turns out to be partially novelistic, the cost of that has risen a lot because once 10 get found out, then it's easier. It's more natural for the next 10 get found out because people are going to be suspicious. So as with anything, again, this is where kind of economics can be applied to anything in life. When the cost of something rises, people tend to consume less of it or produce less of it if you're going to get paid for it less. And so if my chances of publishing a memoir, of publishing a novelistic memoir and calling it a memoir, if there's a better chance that I'm going to get caught, then yeah, I will write what is mostly a memoir but has some made-up stuff and just say it's a novel because it's a lot safer.
Switching gears here, let's talk about sports. You discovered the home field advantage is a real quantifiable phenomenon, even when game officials do not intend to favor one team. So what gives?
Yeah, so without question, home field advantage in sports is real. We looked at the five, I guess, major sports in the U.S. if you count major team sports, if you count soccer, which I do, I'm a soccer fan. So if you count baseball, basketball, football, hockey, and soccer, and then you look at home field advantage, home field wins across many, many, many professional leagues, even in other countries, you find that without question, there's a home field advantage. I believe the smallest home field advantage is in baseball. It's highest in soccer. It's almost 70% in soccer. So you have to say at some point, okay, so what's causing it? So I can tell you the what's the why? So in terms of the why, there are a lot of answers we could come up with. Athletes perform better in an environment they're used to. Athletes perform better when they're eating home cooking, whether it's literally home cooking or not, or when they're sleeping in their own beds. Athletes perform worse when they're in an unfamiliar place. The crowd influence, or maybe the confines of the sporting arena itself, are good for the home team, and so on. And so, a bunch of scholars have looked at this and tried to measure it. And basically, they found that none of the reasons I just gave can account for home field advantage, but only one can, and the one is referee bias, which is to say, the home team gets more calls in their favor. And again, as you said, it's not necessarily conscious on purpose, but it seems as though referees are influenced by the home field setting, including the crowds, and tend to make one or two calls in favor of the team that might not otherwise go that way. And in a sport like soccer, especially, where one goal can win you a game, that might be enough to inflate the home field advantage to something as high as 70%, which is what it is.
We're here with Freakonomics radio host Stephen J. Dubner, co-author of the new book, When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist, blogger, and radio host Stephen J. Dubner. He's co-author, along with economist Stephen D. Levitt, of the new book, When to Rob a Bank, and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants, taken largely from the Freakonomics blog that you can find online. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Stephen, on the question in sports of anti-doping campaigns, what would change if we just let athletes use any substance they want to enhance their performance on the field?
Yeah, so that's one idea, which on the face of it seems like a ridiculous idea, right? Both for notions of fair play and responsibility. Like, you don't want to encourage people to do things that will make them might make them better at what they do, but might be bad for them. On the other hand, it's an interesting proposal in that if you have an event like the Tour de France where, you know, we've come to learn, you know, Lance Armstrong's defense of why he doped ultimately was pretty basic, which is that, you know, everybody was doing it. And you have almost no chance if you don't do it. So if that's the case, you know, one thing you could say is, well, look, why don't we just, instead of trying to fight a problem that we're not very good at fighting and or, like baseball did for many years, trying to pretend there is no problem at all, why don't we just flip it on its head and say to the people who are best in the world at doing this, What are the drugs you use? Okay, let's make them available to everyone. And that's the way we'll level the playing field. And if, you know, because if the idea is it's bad for them and you don't want to encourage their likelihood to do it, well, they're already doing it. They already feel, it's like the NFL, you know, if you feel the risk of getting injured in the NFL, which is pretty substantial, is worth the pay in every way that you get doing it, financial pay and otherwise, you know, that's a human's choice to make. So, you know, that would be one solution to doping. It's not a very satisfying one, but to me, it might be a little bit more satisfying than fighting it the way we've done it in the past. On the other hand, I think doping is one of those things where technology, as it gets better, is going to help us a lot. So one simple thing you can do is, you know, when you submit when you have a blood test for doping now, let's say in the Olympics, you know, one way to do it is to say, we're going to collect your blood now, and then you compete. And if you come up clean afterwards, great. But just so you know, we're going to bank this blood for 20 years. So any technology that comes along in the next 20 years that can detect something that was illegal now, but we didn't know how to test for it, you know, we'll take your medal away then. And so that might be a nice kind of half measure to make things a little bit better.
So segueing to another kind of drug use, given what you do for a living, how interested are you, what are you interested in looking at states like Colorado in particular that has allowed for the legal use of recreational marijuana? Is that a good lab in which to experiment with all the concerns that we've had all these years with, you know, the slippery slope effect and the gateway drug effect and, you know, the dangers of legalizing a substance that exists primarily to make people high?
Yeah, that would seem to be a really good lab, along with Washington. I mean, it'd be nice if there were 10 other states, or honestly would be really good is if there were 10 states, each with 50 counties in them, that were kind of randomly distributed and you could and half had legalized marijuana and the other half hadn't. And then you could take the results from there, because that would be a lot more scientific. But given, you know, life, given taking what life gives you, looking at Colorado and Washington and any other states that kind of get there, it is a good thing. And so there's a lot of things you can look at. You can look at, does marijuana lead to other drug use? What does it do to alcohol use? Is it a complement? Is it a substitute? You know, if you look at the data, if you look at the health data, it would appear to be that many, many, many more adverse health events are caused by alcohol than marijuana. In other words, medically, it would seem that alcohol is a lot more dangerous than marijuana. Now, there's a caveat there, which is that we don't have as much good data on the marijuana because it's illegal. So you often don't know how much someone's been smoking marijuana compared to drinking, not that you necessarily know that. But also, because alcohol is legal, a lot more people are free to consume it. And so it may be that marijuana turns out to be that bad. But you'd want to look at health effects. You'd want to look at driving. You'd want to look at education. You'd want to look at the economics of it. So, yeah, there's a ton to see. My guess, and it's really only a guess, is that it will turn out to be just such a not big a deal. I don't know how to put this grammatically, not as big a deal as people think on a lot of dimensions. Because I think we probably overestimate the pent-up demand for people who want to smoke a lot of marijuana who weren't smoking any before, and then B, you know, how that's going to change behavior because a lot of people already were smoking it. And theoretically, when you make a real legal regulated market, people will probably be able to be a little bit better at it, know what they're getting and know how to modify their behavior. So if I'm going to smoke marijuana, you know, for instance, I'm not going to do it when I'm taking care of my kids or driving and whatnot. So that's why I think that it will probably be not as dramatic a series of effects as people tend to think.
Tipping comes up in the book in a couple of different capacities. And I wonder what you make of the wave of campaigns we've heard recently. Anyone who doesn't believe that the minimum wage is adequate should start tipping significantly more for services just out in the real world.
Yeah, you know, that's one way to fight it. And that, you know, that's something that personally I kind of do. When I'm in an environment where there are people who are doing their job, and I guess especially doing it well, but honestly, I just feel like doing their job, period. And I know that they're getting paid not very much. I do. I use tipping as a kind of corrective against that. On the other hand, tipping is terrible in that it is such an awkward, inefficient way to pay people for the work they do. It's awkward and inefficient because it's kind of random. You know, you take 10 people, 10 customers. Some are going to tip a lot. Some are going to tip some. Some are going to tip none. You know, this is what economists in particular get really frustrated, this kind of transaction, you know, where there's a lot of gray area. They say this is what prices are for. So if I want to come into a restaurant or fly on an airline or get, you know, buy clothes or whatever, tell me what it costs. And then I can say, yes, I will pay you for that, or no, I won't. And maybe I can offer to pay you less for it, and you're free to accept it or not. So it's really weird that some places you can bargain, other places you can't bargain, and so on. But tipping is just the murkiest, most awkward, most inefficient way of trying to kind of, quote, make up for a low wage. It would just be better for everyone involved if tipping were not such a big component of how people earn their livelihoods, because it's just too random and awkward.
Are the real beneficiaries of the tips that you and I pay, at the end of the day, the people who gain most, the business owners who are earning a profit from the labor of people that they don't pay a living wage to?
I think the answer to that is yes, although, you know, it's not like everybody who gets tipped isn't earning a living wage, that's for sure. But yeah, look, a prima facie, it seems to be kind of ridiculous that one of the few instances in which you can pay someone less than the legislated minimum wage is in restaurant work, right? And the reason that you can do that is because you can, quote, make up for it in tips. Now, it turns out that if you talk to people who live on tips for a living, which is a lot of people, you know, they often do really well. If you ask someone, would you rather be a bartender and get $4 an hour and all the tips you want, all the tips you can earn, or $15 an hour and no tips, a lot of tipping can work out really well. But that doesn't mean it's the best way to, you know, pay people. You know, a lot of economics is just basically about allocating resources. How do you let the most people get what they want or need, especially when they're competing for it against other people? And that's not easy, but it's something I believe we should all strive for, because, you know, when people make a lot of money, it turns out that they only get a little bit happier. To go from making good money to making a lot of money, they only get a little bit happier. To go from being very poor to being middle is a huge boost. So there's a diminishing return on income as it relates to happiness. And so because we know that, I think it's a good idea to try to get as many people as we can from very low to the middle. And then I think there'd be a lot less angst about the difference between the middle and the upper end, because you've got the middle being truly satisfied, and we're not there yet.
A lot of people are still paying attention to events and recovery efforts in Nepal. Your essay on the response of American donors to foreign natural disasters was fascinating. Why do we respond more generously to some catastrophes overseas than to others?
Well, this is a little bit depressing and probably not that surprising, but the data show it to be very, very, very much true. Basically, it boils down to three letters, which are CNN, and CNN being a proxy for news coverage. So there's an effect in economics known as the CNN effect. And basically, if you take two exactly equivalent disasters, right, one in country A, call it Nepal today, and one in country B, call it Kenya tomorrow, or both of them happening today. And, you know, how much money they raise will be absolutely a direct proportion of how much coverage they get. So for every, you know, 30 seconds or so exposure on CNN, for every 10 column inches of coverage in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, the donation will increase many, many fold. And it's not just about the obvious part, which is exposure. Like, oh, I learned about that tragedy, and therefore I know now that I have the opportunity to give money. It's just about how, in a kind of perverse way, news coverage of a tragedy will kind of brand it. And whether it's for buying things that we want to wear or eat or play with or whatever, or where we want to spend our money to help other people, we respond to brands. And so, you know, Katrina became, for lack of a better word in this case, a brand. There are certain events that, because of the news coverage, capture our attention, whereas there can be, like I said, an identical event that claims as many lives, but the amount of dollars per life given will be, you know, pennies on the thousands of dollars just based on how much coverage they get and how, you know, how the brand kind of stirs up our altruistic motives.
I was wondering if tourism is a factor in the kind of coverage it gets, because a place like Nepal is quite remote, and yet certainly a lot of Americans with ample financial resources, if they haven't gone there, they always think, I'd like to go to Nepal. They don't necessarily think the same about, you know, Afghanistan, which can have an earthquake.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So it could work in that direction. I can think of another direction that would work in, which is, you know, the stories that become big stories, we think they become big stories because they need to be big, because they're so important. But the fact is, anybody who's worked in journalism knows that there are 10 stories in any given day that could become the big story. And at some point, there is a person, there's an editor or there's a producer who says, oh, this is the one that leads, or this is the one that goes on page A1. And then once that person does it at the New York Times or at NPR or whatever, everybody follows. So the snowball effect is absolutely massive. So it could be another follow-up to your thought about a tourist-friendly place. If a bad thing happens in a place where that news producer or newspaper editor has visited before and has some familiarity and like, oh, a bad thing happened in this place, you know, that's the way, again, that our minds work. I don't mean to criticize our minds. I love the human mind. It's pretty neat. It's a good little machine. It's a great computer. It's got emotional sensitivities and filters that computers will never have, that robots will never have. But it's also got some flaws, that's for sure.
When you open up a newspaper or flip on your tablet to read news and what's going on in the world, do you keep a notebook next to your device? Or how do you sort of track the things that you think, I want to know more about that?
Yeah, kind of just like that. I do. So I'm not that old. I'm kind of medium old. I'm 51. So I grew up, you know, my dad was a newspaper man. My dream was to become a newspaper man. I did ultimately, and that was awesome. I loved it. I worked at the New York Times for 5 years. So I grew up with papers. But I also, I guess in my late teens, started using computers, which was relatively early for that. And so I'm very, very, very comfortable. I consume information in all media, electronic and paper and so on. So I don't know whether it's because I'm old-ish, because it's the thing I learned on, or because it's better. But I definitely have better reading comprehension, and I have better thinking I think better about something when I read it on paper. So if it's a book I'm reading for ideas or a newspaper I'm reading to really get it, I want to read it on paper in part so I can rip it out and take notes. And if I want to just kind of consume like a vacuum machine, then I'll go to the electronic version. But yeah, I still have piles of stuff I tear out and stick in pockets and then do something with later. No pennies.
Journalist Stephen J. Dubner is host of Freakonomics Radio and co-author of the new book, When to Rob a Bank and 131 More Warped Suggestions and Well-Intended Rants. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Chris, that was a blast. Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy, associate produced by Lindsay Connect, and executive produced by Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.